You may have seen her as Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, or Helen in Decadence, or Diana in Hansard, or Blanche in A Streetcar Named Desire, or for that matter, a few other prized Tennessee Williams roles. Plenty of Shakespeare too. Let's just say I could spend the next half an hour listing the parts that Dr. Fiona Ramsey has played in a stage and screen career spanning some 5 decades. Happily for you, however, in this episode of Shake the Sword, you'll be listening to Ramsey herself. Ramsey was recently at the Drama Factory in Somerset West to portray Stella in Blonde Poison, the role that earned her the 2025 Fleur de Cup Award for Best Performance in a One-Person Show. Written by Gail Lowe, the play tells the story of Stella Goldschlag, who notoriously collaborated with the Gestapo in Nazi Germany to identify and expose her fellow Jewish people who were in hiding in Berlin. Stella's parents were enamored of German Kultur, or high culture, and she grew up listening to the strains of Schubert and Schumann. That's the first of Robert Schumann's Kinderszenen, Scenes from Childhood, composed in 1838. If you've listened to Shake the Sword before, you'll know that we like to slip in some music wherever possible, and Blonde Poison takes us in a very different musical direction to previous episodes. By the way, I'm Chris Thurman, the director of Wits University's Tsikinya Shaka Center, or TCC for short, and the host of this podcast. I was truly privileged to interview Fiona Ramsey during a break from the tech get-in for Blonde Poison, and to talk about her recent appearance as the title character in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Well, Fiona, welcome to the Drama Factory and welcome to Shake the Sword. I'm so glad that while the tech team are plotting the lighting design for Blonde Poison, you and I can have this conversation. Now, there are any number of ways that I could introduce you. There's your enormous repertoire as a performing artist, including so many accolades I can't count them. There's your work as a dialect coach. Rather self-promotingly, I would want to emphasize your affiliation to the TCC and to Wits University. As a scholar and teacher, you've been head of the Theatre and Performance Program at Wits. But perhaps above all, I should mention that today is your birthday. So we're especially lucky to have you here when you could be taking the day off. Although I know you said to me before we started recording that it's a privilege for a performing artist to be working on their birthday. Either way, it's wonderful to have you here. And we will be talking about Shakespeare, of course, but it's worth mentioning that Blonde Poison has been travelling widely, and wherever our listeners may be, they might find themselves near a theatre where you will be performing the play soon.
So it's had an interesting journey, because it started in 2016 when Ismail Mohammed asked us, when he was still running the National Arts Festival, asked if I had a vehicle that was about displacement or war or isolation. And it was a women's festival, a solo woman show, either written by women or performed by women. And in fact, with this play, it was written by a woman, directed by a woman, and performed by a woman. So we took the bull by the horns. We said, yes, let's do it. And Jana Ramos-Violante directed it. And it had quite a lavish set. It had a soundscape that ran from beginning to end. It was about an hour and 10 minutes. And I did it in 2 or 3 runs in Daphne's Theatre in Johannesburg, in the Theatre on the Square. It never travelled to Cape Town, sadly. I think it was because I was very much involved with Wits at the time, being teaching in the Theatre and Performance Department, that I couldn't take time out as regularly as I can now that I'm retired. But so what we wanted to do is we wanted to for it to be able to travel. And with the cumbersome set, that was obviously not possible. So Fred Abramser and Marcel Mayer reimagined it, that I could take a suitcase with 4 props, couple of shards of glass and two light bulbs and find a chair somewhere and do it. So it's extraordinary what has happened to the piece being pared down. I think the message is far stronger. I think the performance is more compelling because it's more focused. And I think the issues that the play grapples with, which is about, I suppose, duplicity, about spying, about changing allegiances to protect yourself, to save yourself, to survive, I think those stand in much more stark relief than if it is couched with a lovely, lavish set that can, you know, you have nowhere to look. You just have to look at the actress and the chair and deal with the words. And it's quite a searing piece, you know, which details and her life as a survivor of the Holocaust by turning Greifer, which is a catcher who used to point Jews out to the Nazis. So it's a very, what she did was very bold and blunt and horrific. But the play manages to grapple with the humanity of human frailty and how was she that wrong? Was she a good person that just did a bad thing, or was she a bad person? She certainly was a confident person who had no issues about whether people would fall in love with her. She had no problem about using her wiles and her sexuality to gain access to those areas where she might find herself in a position to be able to confer with the enemy, as it were.
You've mentioned your work with Fred Abramso and Marcel Mayer. Of course, you've collaborated with them on various productions in the past, including in recent years a couple of Tennessee Williams plays, and you've just completed the first run of Julius Caesar, in which, of course, you played Caesar. I'd love to talk to you a little bit about that process. First of all, as you were just discussing considerations of gender and power, I suppose for most people the noticeable bold decision in this production is the way in which it reframes our understanding of the masculinist world of Roman politics. In Shakespeare's Roman plays, women's voices tend to be marginalized. One thinks of Portia and Calpurnia's unheard pleas. But this production has you playing a woman, Queen Elizabeth, an historical figure, playing the character of Julius Caesar. Tell us more about that.
I think it came about, or certainly Fred and Marcel seem to indicate that it came about because very often there has been a trend for female actresses or actors, female actors, to play male roles, but seldom are they contextualized. And I felt quite strongly that it needed a context before I just played Julius Caesar. And the Essex Rebellion seemed a very good way to pinpoint it. As we know that Elizabeth I was a commanding, very powerful monarch, probably, and more masculine in a way. She was quite a masculine. She never married. She wanted to maintain her power. Whether she couldn't marry or couldn't have children, that's all been surmised in history. But she was kind of a monarch, but she was fairly autocratic in her monarchy, in her reign. But I think that likening the rebellion in which people were uprising against in Ireland against her, she sent Essex off to go and quell the rebellion, which could maybe, had it not been quelled, could have resulted in her being assassinated. I mean, that's the ultimate goal was to do that, to assassinate her. And of course, the history of England would be very different if that had happened. So we felt that Shakespeare had written this, really had written Julius Caesar to raise that rebellion, bring it to the fore of people living in Elizabethan England at the time. So although some of the audience didn't get that, we do have a lot of program notes highlighting that and trying to draw comparisons between it. But so Elizabeth I starts the play, and in that way it is almost a play within a play within a play, because she says those very lines from Henry V, which we start with, where a kingdom for a stage, princes to act and monarchs to behold. She is the monarch beholding. And then later in the speech, she says, admit me chorus to this history, which is, I'm going to play a part. She doesn't play the chorus, obviously. She plays the lead, being the queen. I had wanted to put in a line saying, who better to play Caesar but I? But obviously we wanted to stay true to Shakespeare, and that doesn't exist anywhere in any of his works. So I think that was the thinking behind it, to draw parallels between the power of the time that Shakespeare was writing about and for, and draw a parallel with Julius Caesar.
And of course, the opening chorus from Henry V has that explicit reference to Essex and to his popularity. The general of our empress coming from Ireland with rebellion broached on his sword, etc. This device of borrowing lines from one Shakespeare play to create a metatheatrical effect, introducing the action of another play, is something that Abrahams and Meyer Productions have experimented with previously. Their Hamlet was inspired by the story of the Red Dragon, the apocryphal account of British sailors performing Shakespeare's plays while their ship was at anchor off the west coast of Africa in 1607. So this Hamlet becomes a play within a play, and the actors are sailors, and they speak the lines of the rude mechanicals from A Midsummer Night's Dream, Is All Our Company Here, and so on. It's a really effective way, in both cases, I think, of framing each production, almost inviting the audience to be part of the storytelling process.
I also think that a lot of Shakespeare, because he was so prolific, obviously, which we know, a lot of his plays are interchangeable. You could, you know, over the years they've had all sorts of things, potted versions of, where you'd have extracts from. We did a play called Ladies and Gentlemen Shakespeare, where we played, John Carney and I played the major characters, and it was really love stories. That was the theme. And I think that happens so much, and I think that audiences are so aware of the many sayings that exist in his plays and in his work that we use nowadays, that there isn't that resistance or to mixing the plays together, to if there's something that's it seemed to fit Henry V. And of course, the epilogue that we do in the play comes from Henry VIII. And that was about, it's actually written for her christening, and we adapted it for her death, where they talk about what will become of this queen, and she talks about going to her death, which I thought was quite poignant.
Well, I am eagerly in favor of revising, adapting, translating, taking apart and reconstituting, and otherwise playing with Shakespeare, as those who've listened to this podcast before or follow the work of the Tsikinya Chaka Center will know. And I thought this might be an opportunity for us to explore the way that you, whether as a teacher or as a mentor or in your own performances, have done some of that revising and adapting. We can talk about your work with WITS students in a few minutes, but a way into that, especially as this podcast focuses on Shakespeare and translation, a way into that is talking about your work with accents and as a dialect coach. And that's a whole component of your professional life with the Speakeasy Vocal Academy you established. But I'm interested to know how you understand it to apply specifically to Shakespeare.
I think that over the years, Shakespeare has always been seen to be, you need to speak perfectly, you know, well, to be able to articulate Shakespeare. We know that original pronunciation was not the pronunciation of received pronunciation now, but was slightly broader and had more warm tones in it. And that famous line of how vowels were pronounced, if this be, oh, I can't remember the line now.
If error this be, and upon if me proved. Proved. That, yes.
And it's if this be error and upon me proved.
Yes.
I never lived, nor no one ever loved.
Yes.
And so those sort of things, you can see how they were pronounced by the rhyme scheme of and the way the words were pronounced in those days. What fascinates me is taking Shakespeare out of received pronunciation and actually doing anything with it, turning it into Italian, turning it into, you know, an Italian English, but an Italian accent. Seeing what happens to the words, I think it's a fascinating thing. And in fact, when I was rehearsing Julius Caesar, I did it in Italian, I did it in American, I did it in German. In a sense, to take all these fascist leaders or authoritarian leaders and see how it would have sounded in their Mussolini, Hitler, Trump. I did do it in Russian as well. And it's incredible what I always find, it's incredible the residue that leaves. Mm. So we talk about the universal language of Shakespeare. It's only universal if everybody can kind of has access to it. So translating into another language, yes, is one thing, but an accent is even easier for people to access Shakespeare. So that's been a lot of my projects at WITS have been that. And what I do is I take the heritage of the actual student, their heritage. For example, one of my students was Greek, and so she translated Hermia into Greek. And she did it with a Greek accent, and then she did it in RP. So that you can, in RP, then you've still got residues of that. Whether Shakespeare actually ever heard those sort of accents when he wrote, I don't know. Mm. But I think that it's valid to try that. So obviously also we did Cleopatra, I remember, and the girl that did it was Setswana speaking. And so she did it in Setswana and played it as this beautiful nubile Setswana princess, and that was fantastic. So I just think this, and the other one that was quite interesting, which is particularly relevant now, is one of the students was of Arabic heritage, and he took Shylock's speech and swapped it around and did as if an Arab to a Jewish person, which is particularly resonant at the moment.
Absolutely. There are so many things to pick up on there. One of them is thinking about different voices of authority or authoritarian voices of the past and present in the world of your Julius Caesar production, which of course includes snippets of speeches from a few famous orators, some of them much loved leaders, others figures who have not been or will not be judged kindly by history. It creates this kind of multivocal soundscape that allows the audience to reflect on how Julius Caesar is a play through which one can debate the legacy of leaders, staging, as it does, discussions about what gives you the right to power and also the exercise of power. And it makes those so applicable to the way we understand 20th and 21st century history.
I think what is extraordinary about Julius Caesar is that we are subjected to CNN every day, if we watch it, of debates in the Senate, debates in Congress, debates in specialist meetings, specialist investigations. And that's really what Julius Caesar is. Mm. It's about the Senate. It's about what happens just outside the Senate, in the halls of the Senate, in the corridors. And I think it's kind of what's going on right now in America particularly, but probably in every government throughout the world. And it's not so remote, you know. And I think what was clever as well about what Marcel and Fred did is setting it in Elizabethan right at the beginning, with Elizabethan actors playing Greek figures, then moving into the toga and Greece, and then moving into modern one day with flak suits. What do you call those? And so I think that whether or not the audience came with us, I'm not sure, but it did try to make the point that, you know, this history just repeats itself and it happens in every single cycle.
As you say, the program notes conveyed very eloquently, but I don't think you would need prompting to follow that trajectory. What was notable to me was the transitions between historical periods that are subtle enough that the residue of the Elizabethan period and then the residue of the, let's call it the toga period, is still there with you. So that when somebody on stage is suddenly looking at a digital screen, there's an element of pleasurable surprise, as if that screen has somehow come from 2,000 years ago. It's a wonderful collapsing of the centuries that reminds me of that illustration of Titus Andronicus, the so-called Peachum drawing or the Longleat manuscript, which is the only image we have contemporary with Shakespeare that hints at costuming in original performance. So you have characters who are dressed in the clothing of some stage of ancient Rome, others who are there in probably some kind of medieval armor, and others who are in Elizabethan dress. So these different historical periods are present visually on the stage in Shakespeare's time, and it's all the more effective to have those layers present for the audience today. The other thing I wanted to pick up on is what you were saying about your work with the Witt students, and maybe we can think about this pedagogically, that is in terms of teaching practice, but also performance practice more generally. That accented Shakespeare's help actors to get inside a character, to understand motivation, to make it personal. I guess it can also help an audience to have something tangible, something that aids their interpretation and an understanding of the performance, or gives them a point of reference at least. And I suppose these two perspectives meet when members of an audience, or perhaps students who are not actors in training but are engaging with the play in some other way, textually maybe, place themselves at least in the position of the actor, imagining the role, feeling the performer making sense of the moment and conveying that sense to the audience. There's such an inbuilt theatricality to Shakespeare's work in that way.
I think so, because I think that an actor can only convey what they know if they've investigated it. And I think the danger of performing Shakespeare is that everything seems so remote, you know, in terms of its historical context, in terms of how people spoke, in terms of how I don't mean to distill it in any way or to dumb it down, or I'm really not in favor of changing Shakespeare's words for an audience to understand. I think that you may change doth to does. That might be a simpler way, but that doesn't change the meter. It doesn't really change too much about it. But I'm not in favor of that, because I think if the actor can't convey what Shakespeare meant, the emotional narrative arcs, you know, at the same time, simultaneously, then they shouldn't do Shakespeare. They should do something else. And that might sound quite harsh, but I really believe that. I think somebody said, does a performer need a certain technique to perform Shakespeare? And undoubtedly you do, because you have to hear the words, you have to understand the words, you have to comprehend prosody and meter. But also, you know, some of the words are so archaic that you have to be able to say them in a way that a modern audience understands them. So I've never really analyzed it, but I do think, I always say that to students when they're in their first year, I say, what is the greatest tool you have at your disposal for interpreting a poem or anything? They often say a good voice or this or that. And I say, no, it's general knowledge. Because the more you know of so if you know the word sad, but you don't know dejected, and you don't know desolate, and you don't know suicidal, your performance is going to be as deep as sad. So the more you have at your disposal, the more experience you have. Students extrapolate that by saying, oh, so we should go out and get drunk. We should go out and do everything we can. And I said, to a certain extent, yes, but not to your own detriment. Yeah. But I think that is, Shakespeare demands a breadth of experience and understanding. And I don't think it's vicarious understanding. I think it is something that is physical. It's almost visceral. And so I do think a Shakespearean actor does need certain more, they certainly need a technique that can facilitate that. They need to be heard. But it's more to do with experience and general knowledge and how they can imbue it and how they can. I always say to students, Shakespeare always talks in terms of contrasts. And that is his great, that's how we understand the world. You can only understand happiness if you understand great dejection or ecstasy, or, you know, and so unless you have an appreciation of that, or frugality, or, you know, having nothing, or despair, or so from that point of view, I do think and therefore it helps them, it helps the actor, and it helps the audience if there's a connection, if your heritage mourns in a certain way, if people in your culture mourn in a certain way, to be able to do that with Shakespeare so that the audience can respond to say, oh, they're mourning now, as opposed to some Shakespearean kind of Protestant WASP notion of it, you know.
Yeah.
So that's my kind of into Shakespeare. Anything that can enable you to flesh it out, to feel more about it. You know, Stephen Burkhoff, who did a lot of Shakespeare's and adapted a lot of Shakespeare's, he used to do it all by mime and acting out and being very demonstrative about imagery. And that was very, very fashionable at a certain time. It's almost become show and tell, which maybe people aren't that keen on anymore. But there's such a vast amount you can do with Shakespeare, you know. For example, you mentioned I did Romeo and Juliet recently at WITS, and it's part of my research project. And we took Romeo and Juliet and we condensed it into 20 pages. And my aim was, it shifted slightly away from accents, but more to, I wanted people to speak Shakespeare like they sing pop music or sing their songs, the same connection, the same passion. And so every scene I said, find a song. And so we wove this into the, and it was the students came up with a name, The Musical Woes of Juliet and Her Romeo. And it was absolutely wonderful. We had local songs, we had Ed Sheeran songs. You know, it was wonderful, and I'm trying to get it done at the market actually for school Shakespeare to see if possible, because the students responded in such, and we did it with six people. It was remarkable. So, you know, I'm open to any exploration with Shakespeare, and I think that's the only way we can continue to keep it within our curriculum.
I'm interested in what you said about an embodied Shakespeare and a linguistic Shakespeare. So your students and professional performers need to draw on their experience of embodied feelings, the gamut of emotions that one runs through. But they also need to draw on synonyms and a linguistic breadth in their repertoire. And that's where I think translation is useful. David Skalkwyk, the South African Shakespeare scholar, some years ago made the provocative but I think persuasive claim that for audiences and readers of Shakespeare, unless you have a language apart from English to call on, where you can experience some kind of translation that updates the text or updates your understanding of the words, then your experience of the original is slightly impoverished. And that's a really cogent way of presenting the idea that being bi or multilingual means you have more synonyms to call on in different languages to enrich your understanding of the word cloud around any given Shakespearean word or phrase.
So when the students are asked to translate into their own language, very often they get their grandmothers to help them because their grandmothers have a better understanding of the savor, Afrikaans or whatever language it is. And I do try and say, do observe assonance, do observe alliteration, see if you can do that. Because it's not just... So, for example, this is a famous sort of quote. We say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And very often in translations, they translate it exactly, you know, as that. But in Sesotho, I think it is, I could be wrong, but in one of the African languages, it is the ember doesn't fall far from the fire, the coal doesn't fall far. So those sort of things you have to translate and use that. So I try and encourage the students to observe rhythm, meter, all that, if it's possible. They eventually, and this has happened to me twice, especially when I was working at the Market Theatre Laboratory many years ago and I did the same exercise. Often the students come back and say, can I just do it in English? but they've explored the possibility. Yes. And I think that that's kind of what maybe David Skalkwyk is talking about, is having access to your own language and then, you know, using that to kind of shore up your understanding in English. Yes. And when I say that, you know, you need a certain technique and some people shouldn't do it, I don't mean they should be dissuaded from doing it. I think that often actors don't feel equipped to do it. And I think you can do Shakespeare if you're prepared to learn how to do, you know. I'm not saying that it's elitist and, oh, there are only a certain amount of us that can do it. I didn't mean that at all. I just meant that people shouldn't be duped into the idea. For example, one of the students with the Romeo and Juliet, they did a whole of Mercutio speech in rap. And it lends itself to that, obviously, because it's iambic pentameter. And we had this sort of rap thing going on underneath. He loved the part. He just absolutely loved it. And he said to me afterwards, he said, I'd never wanted to even read Shakespeare. I was so scared of it, actually, because it scared me. It was not interesting. And he said, I just want to be Mercutio one day.
Mm. I can't help but compare what you described to my own experiences teaching students in a literary studies department. We're acutely aware of my own inability to draw performances out of them, but knowing that in many cases they have acting enthusiasm. In some classes, we do short self-taped video performances. And also because it is ultimately a textual studies course, I will sometimes commission students to read some of the digitized translations that we have of Shakespeare in South African languages from across the 20th century. And that goes back to Sol Plaatje's Setswana in the 1930s, which itself was already a somewhat dated, idiomatic version of Setswana, to K.E. Masinga's isiZulu radio play scripts in the 1950s, and B.B. Mdledle's isiXhosa translations from around that time. And many students say it is as difficult for them to read the language in those texts, even in their home language, as it is to read Shakespeare in early modern English. And it does introduce this intergenerational conversation, where they'll go back to parents and grandparents and say, can you help me with this deep isiXhosa or isiZulu? And that to me is a fascinating impact of the process as well. Now, Fiona, although in the merest technical sense you might be able to describe yourself as retired, that's only insofar as your WITS teaching and administrative responsibilities are concerned. But we know that audiences and viewers can expect to see you on stage and screen for some time yet, and I'd love to know what lies ahead. We spoke briefly about Blonde Poison's travels. Is Julius Caesar going to be traveling?
Fred and Marcel want to travel it. I mean, the aim is to take it to St. Petersburg, to Romania, to all the Shakespeare festivals in Europe, which would be wonderful, and get a chance to travel. I mean, I've had great fun with Marcel and Fred doing Provincetown with the Tennessee Williams. But I am actually going off to, we're going to do the Hollow Crown, which was done by the RSC. Do you remember it? So we are doing that at Hilton Festival. We are trying it out at the Hilton Festival because that we want to include that in part of the Shakespeare repertoire. It's a reading or a recital, kind of like a vocal recital, choral recital. And actually, it's very, it's about 2.5 hours. So what we've decided to do is to condense it into 1 hour and another hour and do two separate programs and kind of perform the one that's most suitable for whatever we're performing. So that's at Hilton Festival this year. And then I go off to Salzburg to play Maria Callas in a very reworked, new version of her life. It's got interviews, it's got an opera singer, it's part who sings for me, or not for me, for Maria, and it's part of the Mozart Festival. So she starts with, I think, Cosi. I think that's the first one we do. But so that'll be exciting. But we're workshopping it, and we're also thinking of writing a film. I mean, I really think I'm on the third stage of my life now, you know, first stage, second stage, and now the third stage. And since I've left academia, I still have been writing, and I'm still going to publish. But I have been trying to get my, you know, back on the boards and back on screen and that sort of thing. So that's what I'm aiming to do. So hopefully you'll see more of me.
Of that I have no doubt. Whether it's in Salzburg, London, Joburg, or back here in Somerset West, I'm sure that audiences can't wait to see you perform again. Thank you so much, Fiona. Join us for another episode of Shake the Sword again soon. For now, Let's stay in the moment and mood of Blonde Poison and play out with some more Schumann. This is the seventh of Schumann's scenes from childhood, Träumerei, that is, dreaming or reverie.